for the Rules Subcommittee today. It's April 3rd, 03. We really appreciate you coming out today on a cold, rainy day. Some of us were hoping for a snow day tomorrow, but I don't think that's going to happen.
It's snow every day in April at my house.
Oh, really?
It has.
Oh, well, let's go cross-country skiing at you. I'm not sure that it's quite enough snow. I'd like Justice Gillette and Steve Dole to come forward on SJR 29.
You're open the hearing, right?
And I'm going to open a public hearing on that measure.
Madam Co-Chair, let me summarize real quickly. Upon approval by voters at the next regular general election, SJR 29 amends the Constitution to establish 7 equally populated judicial districts, requires that a Supreme Court justice be appointed or elected from each district, requires the Legislative Assembly to reapportion the districts. At the same time, it reapportions legislative districts, incorporating, whenever possible, separate districts for Eastern and Central Oregon, Southern Oregon, the coastal areas, and the Willamette Valley.
Thank you. And if Senator Farioli sees that this measure is opened and open for hearing, if he hears this, have him come on in. Please proceed. I don't see him yet, so go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Members of the committee, I'm Michael Gillette, and I'm the Senior Associate Justice on the Oregon Supreme Court, appearing not for the court, but on my own behalf. And I'm going to let Mr. Dole introduce himself now. He is in favor of this measure, and I'm not, and I suppose in an orderly fashion. You probably ought to hear somebody in favor before somebody against speaks up, in addition to which, if we've had a cheerful enough conversation, I think we could probably work this way, if that's acceptable.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I was hoping that the justice would miss that. First of all, I want to say it's a joy to be here because I get used to just appearing in front of the judiciary committees in this building, and I actually got to go in front of House Rules about a week ago, so it's nice to be in front of it.
We hope to have you in front of us much more frequently.
I bet. Senate Joint Resolution 29 is. Is a rule that's probably best explained in the preamble of the bill. This is not a bill that's really about anything more than fair representation and respect of regional interests. To ensure that the Supreme Court represents all the people of the state of Oregon is better than a Supreme Court whose members come from one small geographic area. And requires that the members of the Supreme Court come from throughout the state, that it constitutes a common sense. Now, this bill you probably remember seeing in the election in November as Measure 22. However, this bill differs in the fact that it only districts the Supreme Court, and the residency requirements are somewhat different than what was in Measure 22. And let me... I was actually going to go through a little history on this, but let me tell you what the reasoning behind this change is, and it's very simple. We were approached, if you will, a couple weeks before the election and told in somewhat cryptic or legalistic terms that if Measure 22 passed, that it would probably be tossed out, and it would be tossed out because of Armada. So I guess the fact that Measure 22 was one of the closest, if not the closest, initiatives in initiative history because it lost by 0.4 points, the fact that it won 32 out of 36 counties, and the fact that if you pull Multnomah County out of the mix, it won by close to 34,000 votes, is a moot point because maybe it was a blessing that it didn't pass. Because it appears that something was going to be done about that. At least that's what was indicated to me in this message. But what this districting act is about, whether it was Measure 22 or Senate Joint Resolution 29, is this, very simply, is that this was basically part of the original Constitution. This is what our forefathers had in mind when they wrote the Constitution. In fact, the drafters of the Constitution in 1857 wrote it, and it was ratified by the people in 1859. Now, in 1910, Article 7 of the Constitution was amended. And I'd like to take a moment and read to you, and this is where this is where the statewide election evolved from. And I'd like to take a moment and read to you what the people read when they voted on this amendment back in 1910, and keeping in mind the situation we have today with Armada. This is what they saw when they voted. For amendment to the Constitution of the State of Oregon, providing for verdict by three-fourths of jury in civil cases, authorizing grand juries to be summoned separate from the trial jury, permitting charge of judicial system by statute, prohibiting retrial where any evidence to support verdict, providing for affirmance of judgment on appeal notwithstanding error committed in lower court, directing Supreme Court to enter such judgment as should have been entered in lower court, fixing terms of Supreme Court, providing judges of all courts be elected for 6 years, and increasing jurisdiction of Supreme Court. Even the people that I talked to during the election cycle that opposed this, and some of these were very good attorneys, could not cite for me where in this document it said that we were going to go from district to statewide elections for the appellate court. Now, I'm at a great disadvantage here today. I'm a guy that just barely made it out of business school at Gonzaga University, and I've got a Supreme Court justice sitting next to me. So I'm not a lawyer. I've never claimed to be one. I have to make that clear. The Measure 22, by the way, was supported across the board by many different people of many different philosophical, ideological, and political bents. I have a letter that you should have in front of you, in fact, from Dan Meek. And Dan Meek is no one's conservative, believe me. I'm sure many of you in this room know Dan. And, of course, one of the points that he makes around the issue of districting is, quite frankly, campaign finance reform and what it costs to elect judges in statewide elections. And I think if you'll take the time to read his letter, I've got a copy of it here, you'll see he actually cites the Dominguez Byrne race in discussing the costs of judicial races. But we had judges who supported this measure. If you looked at the voters pamphlet argument, you'd see that the first voters pamphlet was signed by three circuit court judges. And I can tell you this, and I'll say it right now. I had a presiding judge in a county east of the mountains call me and say he basically upheld Eastern County circuit judges and Southern Oregon circuit court judges, and he only found one judge that opposed this thing. So there was broad support among the judges, but obviously for political reasons, and I can imagine this, a lot of them didn't speak out.
Madam Chair?
22 out of 36 district attorneys supported the bill. Ron Saxton, a gubernatorial candidate and a downtown lawyer, supported the bill.
Mr. Joel, I mean, it's a little uncomfortable to have you describe the Dominguez Byrne race that was highly politicized and not give. Would you bring us back the next time we have this before us a list of the monies that were spent in all the Supreme Court races, say, for the past 10 or 20 years?
Well, I guess I could attempt to do that. If I had a large staff, I would attempt to do it. But this was brought by Mr. Meek. This was not brought by myself.
I understand, but you introduced it. You're introducing the information. It would seem to me that, to be fair, you would, at least show us what, everybody knows that this was a highly politicized race, with Mr. Byrne in it. But I'd be interested to see, to make your case, how much political money was involved in the other races.
Well, I'll attempt to do that. Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, I might say this, that in our discussions with other states who have districted their courts, and there are 8 states who have Supreme Courts that are districted, there's 24 states that have Court of Appeals that are districted, one of the things that they universally said was that it cut the cost of these Supreme Court and Court of Appeals races, and I know that there are some in this building who are very interested in the reform of campaign finance. So that's why this came up. I again, the main issue here is this: is that we had an initiative that lost by the narrowest of margins. I think some of the narrowest in history, and it appears that had it won, it would have been a moot point because it was going to be challenged on our model and thrown out. So I believe, and others believe, that that the people should have a shot at this again.
Thank you. Any questions for Steve? Justice Gillette.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, thank you for your courtesy in taking this matter first. It's very much appreciated, I know, by both Mr. Dole and myself. Mr. Dole, I don't know what to do about statements that are darkly attributed to unnamed sources, so there isn't anything I can do about Mr. Dole's alleged sources in his report that this measure, the version of this measure that was on the ballot would have been tossed out under Armada. I have no opinion about that. Let me try to figure it out.
I'm just waving at Senator Farioli behind you to come on up and join you. So,
but Mr. Dole at least suggests that Senator Farioli, I know my place here. This is not my building. If you'd like to speak there, I'm happy to shut up.
I will be honored to hear your testimony, sir.
Mr. Dole at least suggested that the reasons for this proposed change to the Oregon Constitution are to be found primarily in its preamble, and so that's fine. It seems worth reading a couple of the provisions in the preamble. But maybe the first one is the most important. Actually, it isn't. The next to last one is the most important. But the first is important. Whereas it is necessary to ensure the interests of all Oregonians are represented on our highest court. Apparently, electing people statewide from the point of view of this measure, electing people statewide ensures that the interests of everybody won't be represented. That's a non sequitur. There just is no logic in that. But that's the first point that's offered, and then it's followed with this. Whereas it is important that the Supreme Court understand and respect regional interests. Well, let's think about it this way. I've thought about the situation that would exist if, for instance, we were elected by region and I turned out to represent northeastern Oregon because I'm from Milton Freewater. And so I end up living back in Pendleton or Milton Freewater and I represent northeastern Oregon. And a case comes before my court in which this legislative body or the next one has enacted a statute which it had perfectly reasonable power to enact, but which works a considerable hardship on most or all of northeastern Oregon, something dealing perhaps with water rights, something that you always are familiar with if you grew up in northeastern Oregon. And I read the arguments that are being made by the folks in northeastern Oregon who are challenging the act, and I read the words of the act, and it's clear that the act works a hardship on northeastern Oregon. It's also clear that the legislature has the power to do that. Apparently, the theory that's being offered in SJR 29 is that somehow I ought to still vote for some reason that the measure is impermissible because I understand the interests of northeast Oregonians, or I ought to be thinking somehow, gosh, if I vote to sustain this measure, everybody in northeast Oregon is going to be angry at me, and I'm representing them, so I'm supposed to vote that it's impermissible. That, I submit respectfully, is an impossible way to view the judiciary. The law is supposed to be interpreted and applied the way you wrote it, not the way I think my constituency would like to have it turn out. And the idea of having a constituency for an appellate judge is just wrong. It is not philosophically or analytically defensible. I know it. Whatever other reasons can be advanced for doing it, that one won't work. Because a judge is required by the judge's oath to read the law and enforce it, even if everybody's going to be mad at the judge when the judge is finished. And trust me, once in a while that happens. Everybody is angry. But you are still obliged to do it that way. Now let me move on to just one other part of the preamble. Whereas Oregon's founders understood and believed in the principle of regional representation and required Supreme Court districts the Constitution has originally adopted, that's just false. What they did was they took the existing judicial system, which had circuit judges, and they weren't willing to spend the money to have a separate Supreme Court because they knew, as the writers of the Constitution knew very well, the Legislative Assembly would never vote to spend the money. And so they took the existing system, which involved circuit judges, and made the circuit judges the Supreme Court, and provided that those judges had to get together at least twice a year at the state capitol and could meet at a couple of other times if the legislature directed it, provided that the judge who had tried the case could not sit on the appeal and the other judges would constitute the Supreme Court. That's why they did it. It wasn't a belief in regionalism at all. It was a belief in saving money. And the Constitution further provided, originally, that when the state population exceeded 200,000, the legislature would then be authorized to create district trial courts and to make the Supreme Court statewide. And they did in 1878. Mr. Dole's suggestion that it was done in 1910 is incorrect. It was done in 1878 by legislative enactment. And it was done as soon as the state felt that it could afford to have a separate appellate body to review the decisions of trial judges. Until then, the Supreme Court was made up of judges who also tried cases, and they simply put on a different hat when they came to Salem to perform that other duty. So the premise, this statement just isn't so. It just isn't so. I don't mean anybody's trying to affirmatively flummox anybody. I just mean that they looked at the original provision without trying to find out what it meant. That's what it meant. If you want me to, I could probably even dig out the original newspaper articles from 1857, which explain it. But in any event, that's what it's about. That's what the districting was about. So the premise is wrong. The justification is wrong. The claim of historic precedent is inaccurate. What's left of the measure? Well, there's still the argument that whatever I may want to say about it, there's just something appealing, or maybe something politically justifiable that I can't get my hands on, about having judges elected from districts. If it is your sense that somehow you'd get a better Supreme Court out of that, there isn't much I can do about it. I can't begin to imagine why you think that, but if it's your sense that you would, then I guess this gets the vote. But let me add just one more thought, for whatever it's worth. The idea here is supposed to be that somehow when somebody comes from different areas of the state and they all get together, just as this legislative body does, that they bring separate sensibilities to bear on an issue. That's unquestionably accurate as far as it goes. But you bring those different sensibilities to bear on deciding what the wording of the law is going to be and must come to a consensus with respect to the wording. We, on the other hand, are given the wording, given the consensus that's been arrived at by that process, and simply try to identify what it is and inform it uniformly throughout the state. Our task is different, and the idea that we need that same kind of perspective, at least for the same reason, is not accurate. If you want us to actually have that perspective just because we're folks from different places, why is it that the measure requires so little in order for one to qualify? I think the residency requirement is 1 year. Don't I have a lot more to say about the values of Northeastern Oregon, having grown up there, even though when I finally finished law school I ended up practicing in Portland? Don't I know more about that? And don't I, as at least I like to believe this, don't I embody the values that are represented by that area more than someone who went there having grown up in California and gone to law school in Chicago and moved there when they were 30, practiced law for a year and a half, and then get elected to the Supreme Court? What is it you want? If you want values, then what you're really after is people who've lived on the ground and have some sense of the mores of the place. And requiring a year's residency, sure as the devil, doesn't do that. Senator Brown, I've gone on perhaps more than I should, but I'm a little grumpy about this. I might add just one more thing for the edification of those of you who do not realize it. But because this measure, if it's submitted to the people and adopted, would not go into effect until after the next regular election, and because that's the last time I will offer myself to the people to serve on the Supreme Court, I have no dog in this fight. Nobody's going to make me move anywhere, because after that term, I'll be retiring anyway, or at least I'd have no plans to serve beyond my 68th birthday. So I'm not trying to protect myself, but I do care very much about the institution that I've served now for 25 years, and this is the wrong thing to do to it. So thank you.
Thank you, Justice Gillette. Any questions for the Justice? It is kind of nice to be on the other side of the questioning panel. Senator Farioli, welcome. And
Justice Gillette, if you need to get back to the court, that's fine.
Senator Brown, thank you. I'd like to remain. If there may be questions that arise out of Senator Ferriola's comments, that I could be of some help.
Madam Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to be heard on this bill, and it's an honor to sit here with Justice Gillette, and I just would make one observation. For a judge with no dog, he barks pretty loud. I see this as a fundamental issue, not only of fairness, but of fair representation in the state of Oregon for citizens. We can look at some of the premises that were just discussed, and you can ask yourself some questions. First of all, I would just suggest that we
Senator
don't expect...
Senator Ferrioli, I'm getting nudges. You apparently did not identify yourself.
Oh, I beg your pardon, Madam Chairman. I am Ted Ferrioli from John Day, Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Those of us in certainly in rural Oregon, but I think anywhere in Oregon, don't expect our judges to leave their perspectives and their personal life experiences on the peg outside the door. We expect them to bring that information with them. This is really not about where you were born or where you were raised. The good judge asks us to believe that judges simply interpret the words of the law, the literal meaning, and try and discern what our intention was. But that sort of flies in the face of the idea that's something that we've seen certainly from the 60s, and that's activism from the bench. We see activist judges all the time. The idea that we would maintain that judges are not political is a little bit perhaps not exactly at square with the reality. They run in political offices. They run in political elections. They're not allowed to talk about their political affiliations, but that soon becomes evident from the rulings that we see. The fact of the matter is judges are political. And if it was a principle of democracy that judges should not run from districts, perhaps all state legislators ought to be elected at large as well. But we clearly understand that there is a perspective of place, and there is a concept of justice that transcends the letter of the law or even the intent of the legislators, which is something that we gnash our teeth about a lot. When we turn our little birds loose to fly, it's generally the judiciary that makes sense out of what we've done, and sometimes not always the same sense. Judges are political. There's no question about that. There's a discussion here in this bill about referring a question to the Oregon voter about whether or not we should have, in fact, a judiciary that truly reflects the diversity of our state. And I believe that that question has a right to be heard. I think we should put it before the voters.
Senator Ferrioli,
Madam
in terms
Chairman.
Of the bench representing our state, it's currently my understanding that there's no women on the Supreme Court and one Latino. If we were going to really, truly represent the state, I would think we would have a requirement that at least 50% of the Supreme Court would be women. Why not go, I mean, if you really want to represent the state, that to me seems like a more accurate representation. Why not go that route?
Madam Chairman, I think that is a subject that may be ripening and ready for a lawsuit, except you'd have to pursue that remedy in the court system.
Did he say frightening or ripening?
I don't think that is a specious argument at all. You know, we have not applied the same standards of civil rights to the bench as we have other elements of the state of Oregon and other units of government. And I'd be sympathetic to that approach, Madam Chairman. Let me suggest to you that one of the discussions that I've heard about this is that, gosh, all Friday, judges would have to move if they wanted to pursue their judicial career. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because I know a whole bunch of legislators that are forced to face the same issue as a result of redistricting. Districting is no great burden in the judicial system, and it's no great burden in the electoral process, and it's certainly no great burden to the legislature. It's no great burden at the state level. It's no great burden at the federal level for elective office. It's no great burden at the municipal level. So why in the world would it be a great burden in the judiciary? Let me just close by suggesting that you've all heard the old saw that justice delayed is justice denied. Well, let me suggest to you that justice denied is no justice at all, and that's exactly what we have from all of the communities in eastern Oregon.
If you look at the history of judgeships, the last judge from Eastern Oregon that was a candidate, I think, was Judge Aragwin. He was not appointed to the bench. But if you look at the current makeup of the court and the immediate proceeding and go back even a decade or so, what you'll find is that the legal fraternity on the I-5 corridor, Portland, Salem, and Eugene, because that is the center of learning for law and that is the center of power and politics in our state, people build a career, build affiliations, and build statewide recognition in those communities, and that's what gives them the political platform from which they run when they run for the bench. Those opportunities simply are not as well distributed across the state as they ought to be, although there are jurists of fine mind and good ability in every community in Oregon. It just seems that they have to, in order to pursue a career on the bench, go to the centers of power and build their power base for their political office. I guess my point is that I absolutely believe that if we're going to have a fair and representative judiciary, then we need to recognize that there's a disequity in opportunity to run for the bench. Districting or district runs would solve that problem. And this committee is being asked to lay the question not only before the legislature, but to also lay it before the people of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Senator Corcoran.
Yes, Senator Farioli, you said judges are political and judges are activists. Would you give me any examples you may have of judicial activism by the Oregon Supreme Court?
Madam Chairman and Senator Corcoran, when I made that comment, I had in mind not a judge from the Oregon Supreme Court. I was thinking particularly of Judge Dwyer, William Dwyer, from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Dwyer died recently, and his obituary listed him as a lifelong environmental activist. And it struck me as being an unusual thing for a justice of the Supreme Court to be listed as an environmental activist. I don't have an example of that kind of activism at the Supreme Court to illustrate that point. I think the point to me is that judges have a full panoply of emotions and desires just like any other citizen, and they bring those perspectives to the bench with them, and when they put that black robe on, it doesn't necessarily mean that they take off the activist role. And that was the illustration.
So, Ms. Madam Chair, so basically, you have no examples of political activism, judicial activism by the Oregon Supreme Court, but you want to district them because of that.
Madam Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I believe that judges are in a certain sense no different than any other citizen of Oregon that stands for political office. You have to build a political base, you have to get name recognition, you have to raise and spend money, you have to stand for election. And so in that regard, I think that if we're going to elect our judges, they ought to be elected in the same manner that other public officials are elected, and they almost all require some residency requirements to run.
Senator Farioli, Justice Gillette raised the issue of only having to live in the district a year, and I guess my understanding is that you grew up in Portland, whereas Justice Gillette grew up in Milton Freewater, and you both have kind of crossed paths, so to speak. Why is your experience more relevant than his, or why is the fact that my husband, while we were married, lived for a year in Wallowa County, I could have stayed there, I could have run? I mean, how would I have represented that area simply because I lived there for a year better than, for example, someone like Justice Gillette who grew up there?
Well, Madam Chairman, I think the residency question is an interesting one. I moved to John Day in 1994, and I ran for public office in 1996. And was elected in 1997. I was raised in Portland, went to the University of Oregon, and lived in Lane County for about 18 years. So I consider myself having a varied residential career. I moved into Eastern Oregon. I ran against
Bulldog.
A person who lived in that community all of their lives, had never lived elsewhere, and was judged by the electorate to represent that district better. I think the issue of residency for election is one point, and it's an important point. The issue for me today is the closest to my community, as a resident of that community, and that's why I have a continuing residential requirement to hold this office. I have to live in the district that I represent. And that is the same requirement that we see for city council. That's the same requirement that we see for those communities that have a residency requirement for county office. That's the same requirement that we have for legislators. I see no reason why we should make a distinction for the courts.
Your underlying assumption in this bill is that people sitting on the courts and interpreting the law are doing so as representatives of people of a certain area or people of the state. Do you agree with that sort of underlying assumption?
Madam Chairman, what I agree with is the role that we expect of our judiciary is that they will look at the letter and the sense of the law and interpret when there is disagreement about that. But I also understand absolutely that people can look at the same concept and the same word and apply different values and different life experiences. And I just absolutely firmly believe that of wide variety of life experiences will give the bench a better perspective, especially in collaboration with other members of the court that will come from different areas.
Thank you. I think there are no questions. Mr. Dole, did you want to make some comments?
Madam Chair, if I could, Senator Cochran asked about judicial activism. With all due respect, I'm a little bit of a deficit here today because I
have added your
because I don't have attorneys with me, and I plan to, but they weren't able to make it. I'm not going to try to get into a legal debate over Armada, but Armada, in my layman's opinion, was judicial activism at its greatest. We've had the initiative system in the state of Oregon since 1902. They changed the issue around amendments, I believe it was in 1906, to the best of my recollection. We went 92 years with various initiatives that under Armada would have been thrown out, including, by the way, women's suffrage. And yet when Measure 40 came down the pike, it upset so many in the criminal defense bar and in the ACLU, they found a way to pitch that out because they didn't like it. That, in my opinion, was judicial activism.
Madam Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
I wonder if his honor would respond to that accusation. Or
it wasn't an accusation, it was my opinion.
It was my opinion. Justice DeLette, do you wish to respond?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, no, I don't. Steve's entitled to his political point of view with respect to what motivates us, however wrong it may be.
However wrong it may be.
Senator
Byer, do
you have a question?
Yeah, I do have a question.
Okay.
Question.
Senator Byer.
I don't care. And I don't know who's the best person to answer this question, but I'm going to choose
I'm sure they all will.
Only because you and I sponsored the bill along with others. But as I'm looking at it, I'm unclear. Under this, if it were to pass, would the judges have to live in the area and only then the people in that area vote for the judge, or would it still be a statewide election for the judge? But the judge has to come from a certain area.
It's my opinion that the judge would have to establish residency as a primary resident in a judicial district for at least a year before the election. And there, of course, there would have to be reasonable requirements for residency.
Is it still a statewide election, or is it election by?
It would be a district election, Mr. Chairman.
Not sure.
Senator Corcoran.
Senator Farioli, why isn't there a provision in here that the elections be partisan?
Madam Chairman, to the Senator, I believe that the judiciary is currently enjoined from discussing partisanship in their elections.
But, Madam Chair, isn't this a constitutional amendment?
Madam Chairman, it would be a constitutional amendment by referral to the voter if they pass it.
So, Madam Chair, why couldn't you put in a provision that requires it be partisan?
Madam Chairman, I accept the Senator Corcoran's friendly amendment if he is willing to help me sponsor this bill.
Well, I just asked that question to point out the fact that all the sponsors are, in fact, Republican. So, I mean, you know, Mr. Dole's comment about all the the judges he can't name that support this speak, you know, to the fact that this is widely supported. But, you know, there's, I won't characterize the political position of a lot of these folks, some of these folks, but they are in fact all Republicans.
Madam Chairman, to Senator Corcoran, I think they also are mostly rural Republicans, as a matter of fact.
Now you got the stars.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, on that happy note, Mr. Dole, unless it's extremely important.
Madam Chair, it's Senator Corcoran, I was trying to figure
the names that were.
Well, first of all, I want to just read the names of the judges who were on in the voters panel. It was Ted Abram from Klamath County, John Honeycutt, former Circuit Court Judge, Columbia County, Holly Peel, Senior Judge from Washington County, and Frank Uroguin, Senior Judge from Malheur and Harney County. So you had two, one Southern, one Eastern, one from Columbia, one from Washington. I would say this. You know, there were Democrats asked to sign, and they didn't sign. That's the fact.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman, I sincerely appreciate you.
Thanks.
Thank
it's
you.
Great to have all
investing
of you here.
Investing time of the committee on the bill. Thank you.
We appreciate this very interesting conversation. I know that there are other people who want to testify on this bill, but unfortunately, we have a number of legislators who are waiting. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
That will close the hearing on SJR 29. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 722 and invite Representatives Tomei, Senator Walker, Representative Prezansky, and Senator Morissette forward.
Madam Deputy Chair, Senate Bill 722 prohibits smoking in all places of employment and all indoor public places effective July 1st, 2005. It also requires employers to post signs throughout the workplace, and it prohibits smoking in restaurants and bowling centers. That would go into effect in 2004, and it repeals the state preemption of local government smoking prohibitions.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Since you were here first, we're going to start off with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative from House District 41, Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. As one of the previous speakers said, he was cranky. Well, I'm cranky, too. I was reading in Capitol Clips about this bill this morning, and I have no prepared statement. But I became cranky a couple of years ago after the initial bill that passed. That was, 2828, 2 years ago. And did Tony go out for a cigarette? And sorry. Right, yeah. What is it? No decorum. And 2 years ago, we were sold a bill of goods. Not long after this bill passed and it was supposed to have taken effect, I was at the RAM, and some of you know about the RAM. You go there, and I was having a nice cold one. And as I was sitting in the restaurant section where there was no smoking, and there was next to me a family of children and parents also, and smoke was wafting up, and I thought, what is this? So I called the manager, and the manager said, oh, yes, this is perfectly legal, because in the middle of the RAM, as you well know, is the bar, the smoking section. There is no wall. There is no barrier, so all the smoke was coming up into my table and the table that was full of children, number one. Number two, I was in Milwaukee recently at the Sherry's restaurant. Sherry's, before that bill passed 2 years ago, had a smoking section and a non-smoking section. I would always go in the non-smoking section, but a while ago I went in and I was sent over to the section that had been the smoking section that now was the restaurant. Of course, it was no smoking. So I was sitting there with my husband having a lovely meal, and then smoke started wafting out. And I said, what is this? Again, I called the manager, being a cranky sort of person, and she pointed out that there was a barrier, and on it said, I wrote it down, no minors allowed, and it now serves alcohol, and it's now a lottery lounge. All it was two tables with a very small barrier, probably this high. Smoke was coming through. I complained to her. I said, I'm in the legislature. We passed this bill that said there would be no smoking in restaurants. She said, we don't like this any better than you do. But now, so that they can accept smoking, they have this new section where no minors are allowed. It doesn't mean that they can't smell that smoke, which is in the next table. So I'm cranky. We were sold a bill of goods, and I'm hoping that this bill can right that wrong. So
thank you, Representative Tomei.
I'm going to my committee unless you have any questions.
Any questions? I think we don't want to ask you any questions today.
We don't want to mess with you, Representative.
Representative Przanski, were you in line next?
I was number two.
Okay.
Senator, just wanted to make a couple of comments in support of Senate Bill 722. You will probably receive, if you haven't already, some flyers from the American Cancer Society regarding how this has worked since the passage of 2001. Legislation, House Bill 2828. What I really wanted to do is make sure Senator Corcoran understands the importance of this issue. Apparently he has left our presence for some other reason, might be one that we'll have to discuss after today's session. But I also believe that you have also received, I'm going to make certain that Senator Corcoran gets a copy of the online for tough laws to stub out smoking in pubs and clubs, and this is regarding in Ireland. So his birth country has actually noticed as to the issues that they have been faced, and they actually are entering regulations there that will be banning smoking in the workplace, meaning in the pubs, nightclubs, and restaurants. This is something that I know Senator Walker and I believe Senator Morissette will be talking about, the more local experiences that we've seen in the Eugene-Springfield area as to how this has worked. But I did want to be here and on record supporting Senate Bill 722.
Thank you, Representative Przanski. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to keep him here for the next bill. So.
Oh, good. Okay, that's great. And I appreciate my colleagues waited until I got done with another interview. I'm here also in support of Senate Bill 722. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator for District 7. And I'm cranky as Representative Tomei, who used to be my roommate last session. I sat through hours and hours and hours of hearing on House Bill 2828. Actually was a different number at that time, but I called it the committee from hell. It was the Smart Growth and Commerce Committee. It was legendary in this capital for staying till 10, 11 o'clock at night, and we had the room filled, just filled with people talking about the need to implement a smoking ban. And in the end, we got House Bill 2828, which was a compromise that the governor worked out with the Restaurant Association. And as part of that compromise, the governor agreed not to touch the Eugene ordinance. Eugene City Council implemented its own ordinance to ban smoking in all public places. It has worked well. Some businesses will argue that it hasn't, but I think more people are going out, more people are going to restaurants, more people are visiting their local pubs and their night spots because they can come home smelling like they when they left, clean, beautiful, ordinary, and not like a cigarette. So I think this bill would go to the protections that all of Oregonians need, just not 95% of them. And I would bring to your attention, which someone else will probably do today, there was a study released just a few days ago in Helena, Montana. They passed a law that banned smoking, and for 6 months the law was in place and heart attacks went down, and the law was challenged in court, and as soon as the law was lifted and people started puffing again in public places, heart attacks went up. So the evidence will overwhelm you today. I'm not going to keep you. I see notes are being passed back and forth about this wonderful bill. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it today.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Any questions for her before she takes off? Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Most of what I was going to testify to has been said, both the study from Montana, which is not a large study and may not be as conclusive as we would like to think. I'm sorry. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, representing Lynn and Lane County. One of the things, though, that it does talk about in the study from Ireland, which I think is a key point, is that there are people who are victims of secondhand smoke who cannot escape. And there is a choice issue for people to select the restaurant that they go to, but there is not a choice for the people who work there. And the article from Ireland mentions that there are something like 50 lawsuits by people who work in establishments that subject them to smoke that are in the process. And I think that we will reach that point if we haven't already reached it. Secondhand smoke is as dangerous to some people, more dangerous to some people than firsthand smoke, because in one of my extended families, the only person who was ill and died from lung cancer was the one person who did not smoke. So I think that this bill is important to protect people to the right of breathing fresh, uncontaminated air by the negligence, or, you know, the contaminated air is through the negligence of other people who I don't believe have that right. So I think this is a bill that goes to the heart of the victims. And you can go as far back as the airlines industry when they used to allow smoking, and it was the airline stewardesses who said, no way, we're not going to work there if we have to be in that environment. So this is a battle that's been going on for a long time, and I think that this is a good bill, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Morissette? Senator Morissette, do you wish to stay there and testify on SJR 8?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to close Senate Bill 722. Don't get nervous for the rest of you in the crowd.
You're just going to have me testify and then go back, or what?
I'm just going to have you testify on SJR 8
and
then go back to 722.
Okay.
Is that okay with you,
That's
Senator
fine.
Morissette?
I was calling.
That's good, because I have the gavel.
Okay.
Open a public hearing on SJR 8.
Okay.
Did you have a guest that you wanted to come up with you?
Well, Ken Tolnar from the City of Eugene, who is actually the author of the wording and also a book that he wrote, and you can't see this, I see you're squinting, it's called A Case for Local Self-Government and the Role of Oregon Counties. Ken most recently was a member of the Eugene City Council. He worked with the Associated Oregon Counties for many years. He worked with he'll tell you his credentials. This is a very difficult issue because local control, means different things to different people.
Can I have you hang on for just a minute, Senator Morissette? I'd like the committee staff to explain the measure to us.
I can do that. This is SJR 8. Upon approval by voters at the November 2004 general election, amends the Oregon Constitution to prohibit the Legislative Assembly from preempting or restricting chartered city or county legislation on matters of predominantly city or county concern, as those concerns are defined by the city or county charter.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I guess the key there is charter, because when a city or a county gets a charter, that gives them home rule, and that should exempt them from interference by the state on matters that are predominantly of local interest or local concern. And as I was saying earlier, it means different things to different people. But to me, I guess it means mostly preemption of the right of the city to determine such things as toxic right to know, as the city of Eugene passed, that the city of Springfield would not pass, the right to have a restaurant tax, which the city of Ashland passed, to take care of their tourist industry, which flushes the toilets a lot, and that was a way of funding something that they needed to do. Some cities have a gas tax, which I think is appropriate for if they want to do that. And so the preemption issue, I think, is something that grows every single year, and we don't have any way of determining what is predominantly city, or local jurisdiction, or predominantly state. And I think that is the genius of this bill, because it doesn't solve that problem. But it sets up, I think, a mechanism that would allow that to be determined over time, and maybe it would be court decisions, but at least it would give the legislature pause to consider what they're doing. If there was a line drawn, even though the line was somewhat ambiguous, that would be the beginning of what I think would be the final solution, and that would be based on case law over a period of time. But with that, I will turn it over to my friend, colleague, Ken Tolliver.
Senator Brennick.
Thank you. If this passes, would this measure, if a city had been preempted on some issue or another before this passes, would those preemptions be rescinded?
I'll defer.
Okay, we'll wait for that
okay.
one.
Mr. Tolliver, we have your written testimony. Could I get you to
summarize
it? That'd be great. Thank you.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Ken Tolliver. I live in Eugene. As Senator Morissette said, I was a member of the Eugene City Council for a few years. Before that, my credentials, I guess, consisted of having been director of the University of Oregon's Bureau of Governmental Research and Service for about 20 years. And prior to that, about 7 years as executive director of the Association of Oregon Counties, during which time I trod these halls for quite a while, and became a very strong fan of local government. Senate Joint Resolution 8 would protect local legislation against state preemption under two conditions. First, if the local legislation deals with matters of local concern, and secondly, if the local legislation is authorized by a city or county charter. The state preemption has become a real issue, particularly in recent years. As a resident of Eugene, the one that really stuck in my craw was the state preemption of our video poker tax that took place in 1995. After not only had the city council passed that, but also it was referred to the vote of the people, and the people passed it. And yet the state legislature, in its wisdom, preempted it. Senator Morissette referred to the Toxics Right to Know Charter Amendment, which has not been preempted, but has been threatened with preemption in the past two or three sessions. Another one that I was very closely associated with was an effort by the city of Eugene, ultimately successful, to build a bike path through property owned by a private school in Eugene. And that proposal was subject to a state preemption, passed both houses, and fortunately vetoed by the governor. Local governments see preemption as an erosion, if not a wholesale elimination, of the home rule rights that the Constitution reserves to their citizens. The courts have rendered varying opinions interpreting home rule over the years, and I won't take your time to go through that, but I have included a brief summary of the various court interpretations in my written testimony. But the bottom line, I guess, is that both the terms of the city and county home rule amendments and contemporary evidence of their intent indicate that home rule, cities and county home rule jurisdictions are autonomous with respect to matters of local concern. After all, city and county officials are accountable to the same voters and to the same extent as state legislators, and they have the same needs as state legislators for discretion to deal with issues that are within their jurisdictions. Senate Joint Resolution 8 does not prevent state-local cooperation and joint authority on matters of mutual interest. Land use planning is a good example, where the state sets the standards and supervises the implementation of those standards. Local governments apply the standards in making their local land use decisions. There are other examples of that type of arrangement. Senate Joint Resolution 8 clarifies the relationship between the state and the home rule cities and counties. It should be approved by the legislature and forwarded to the voters of Oregon for adoption.
Questions?
Well, I wanted to see if you could address my question about whether the measure, if it passed, would apply retroactively to previous.
I don't see anything in the wording of the proposed amendment that would make it retroactive. Generally speaking, the legislation is proscriptive, I think is the word.
Prospective.
As well as prescriptive.
Okay. Thank you. I don't think there are any further questions. We appreciate you joining us today. Senator Morissette, thanks for being here, and you're welcome to stay while we do the rest of Senate Bill 722, though we do have some executive appointments. Okay, then we better send you back to work. With that, we will close a public hearing on SJR 8. And seeing that we have a quorum, I'm going to open a work session on executive appointments. First, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, which is John Van Landingham.
Members,
Mr. Stembridge.
You each have a packet that includes the information that the governor's office sent over with the interest form filled out by Mr. Van Landingham. And on the first page is your staff's description of the position and the appointment authority, qualifications and duties and authority of the position.
Thank you. Would Mr. Van Landingham come forward, as well as if he's still here? He's not here. He's
not
here. Okay. Gary Harris and Burton Wiest. Nobody here. Ooh, this is not good. We'll be at ease for a moment to see if we can find people lurking in the hallway. Stembridge?
Members, you have the same packet for Mr. Goldberg on the Oregon Health Plan Administrator.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and committee members. For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. This actually gives credence to what Woody Allen said, which is that 95% of life is just showing up. So I'm glad I'm here. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to speak about my experience and qualifications as they relate to the position of Administrator of the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. I'm a family physician. I've dedicated my career to caring for people and to improving the way we organize, deliver, and pay for health care. I've got a special interest in improving the health care of our most vulnerable citizens. In the interest of full disclosure, based on the previous testimonies, I'm neither cranky, but I am a New Yorker. I hope you won't hold that against me. I graduated from Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, did a residency in family medicine at Duke University, taught at Duke University for a while, and then served for 5 years as a commissioner.
Dr. Goldberg, we won't hold that against you either. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was a commissioned officer in the Public Health Service for 5 years, and served as medical director and director of community health services for the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in Zuni, New Mexico. I came to Oregon in 92 to join the faculty at Oregon Health Sciences University School of Medicine. I came there to direct a program to improve the health of migrant and seasonal farm workers. While at OHSU, I was involved in a number of teaching and administrative activities, helped found a primary care clinic at the Clackamas County Public Health Department that cared for indigent patients and actually saw patients there up until this past February. For the past 4 years, was medical director of Care Oregon, the state's largest Medicaid HMO, serving clients under the Oregon Health Plan. Been involved in a number of statewide and national healthcare activities, was a federal primary care policy fellow in 1994, was president of the National Primary Care Policy Society, have been president of the Oregon Public Health Association, and served as chair of the state's Public Health Advisory Board. I think my experiences have provided me with an understanding of health problems and health care from a variety of perspectives, that of program administrator, managed care medical director, as a physician who saw patients, and most importantly through the lives of the patients who I took care of, most of whom were on the Oregon Health Plan or uninsured. My vision for the Office of Health Policy is one, that it be a resource to the legislature and the governor, and to help inform policymakers in the state to provide assistance in the development of sound health policy, to provide evaluation of the ability of our healthcare system to meet the needs of our citizens, and to staff the statutorily required commissions and councils that are run out of the office. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Questions?
Sarah. Okay. Sarah Corcoran, any questions?
No. Are you going to fix the crisis in pharmaceutical drug industry nationwide for us?
Nationwide, I will do my best.
Thank you. That's all we need.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. See, if there are no questions, you can please have a seat.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to open a close the public hearing and open a work session on the appointment of Dr. Bruce Goldberg as Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I move we approve the confirmation of Bruce Goldberg as Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research.
Thank you. Senator Burdick has moved that we approve the governor's appointment of Dr. Goldberg as Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the motion is approved. Thank you, and congratulations if you really want it.
Yeah, condolences.
Yes. Mr. Van Lanningham, come on up. I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on the appointment of John Van Lanningham to the Land Conservation and Development Commission. And is Gary Harris and Burton Wiest in the room, or some representatives? Mr. Harris, come on up. And I see Mr. Chandler would like to present as well. Did you already give it one of these?
I did.
Okay.
I can give another one.
Mr. Chandler?
We do let him testify as well. He is a member of the...
I thought he was only allowed on my House side. No?
Thank you, Senator Corcoran. We need humor over here on occasion.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, I apologize for being absent from the room. I was having my ears boxed by Mr. Chandler. And as you can imagine, it takes a while. I'm currently a member of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. I was appointed by Governor Kitzhaber in February of 99. I was not confirmed by the Senate for a year. I've served, 3 years. I'm currently the vice chair of the commission. Governor Kulongoski appointed me to another term, another 4 years, subject to your confirmation. I would like to be reconfirmed or reappointed.
Thank you. Please
Senator Brown, I'm Gary Harris, and I reside in Madras, Oregon, for the record. And I wanted to come over today, and I drove through the snow to come over and support John. I also serve on the LCDC Commission and have served for 6 years. And I would like to say some words on his behalf, if you want me to do it at this time.
Please proceed.
I know it's not customary to take testimony on somebody else's behalf normally, but I appreciate to be able to talk to you today. I'm an R, John's a D. I'm a natural resource farmer, John's a housing advocate lawyer. I live in Eastern Oregon, he lives in Eugene. How did I strike a friendship up with this guy? Because he does a great job as a commissioner. And of the 6 years that I've been on the commission, I've seen a lot of commissioners, and John is one of the best. And I wholeheartedly think that he's worth retaining. He's attentive, he's bright, he attends all the meetings, he becomes prepared, he's well-read, and he has a legal education that's so valuably needed on our commission, because our laws are so complex and involve legislative decision or legislative statutes and court decisions and our administrative rules. So we need John's presence on our commission. If he's from Eugene, in all deference to Senator Cochran, we think of people from Eugene as on the east side of the state, we think of people as extremists, obstructionists, and preservationists. And John fits none of those categories. He's bright, he's open-minded.
Madam Chair.
Pardon? Senator Cochran.
I reside at 34475 Kaiser Creek Road, Cottage Grove, Oregon.
Oh. I thought you were.
I am wearing Birkenstocks, but I hate granola.
I went to school in Eugene, but I still have some Eastern Oregon roots that are quite strong. And like John said, he's only served 3 years, but in those 3 years, he's become a valuable member. He's risen to vice chair. He serves as a legislative liaison and serves on our executive committee. If you ask me about John's biases and his opinions that might influence your decision, I couldn't think of any. And there's none that really stand out because he remains a facilitator. His greatest strength is to be able to facilitate and look at two stakeholder groups presenting opposing views, and he gets the commission many times to come to consensus and lead Oregon's land use system. So don't pass on this opportunity to put this fine citizen forward. And if you haven't met John yet, I would encourage you to do so because he's a deserving citizen. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Harrison. Thanks for coming all that way. Appreciate that. Mr. Chandler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, legislative advocates here on behalf of a number of clients in support of John Van Lanningham's reappointment. Very briefly, this, as you know, the land use system is again in a state of flux. The Department of Land Conservation and Development's budget, again, is in difficulty. Mr. Van Lanningham has been one of the best commissioners it's ever been my pleasure to serve with. We haven't agreed on everything. I trust him. And in this day and age, that at this time in the state and at this juncture of the state's land use system, environmental regulations, the economy, and all, we need that. If he were to have not asked for reappointment, I would have personally been quite disappointed. My clients would have been hurt, I believe, by that. I think he is a good man. I think he's probably got rocks in his head for agreeing to do this again. I hope you give him the opportunity to do so, though. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these gentlemen? Thank you. We are in work session. Do I have a motion?
I'll move.
Senator Beyer has moved the reappointment of John Van Lanningham to the Land Conservation and Development Commission. Is there any further discussion?
Well, other than my feelings are hurt a little bit by that fine man from Hermiston, I'm going to support the motion.
Okay. Seeing no discussion, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion is approved, and Mr. Van Lanningham, you are signed up for another term on the LCDC. Good luck. You're going to need it.
Subject to floor approval.
Subject to floor approval. We do need carriers for both. Okay. For Dr. Goldberg, would somebody like to carry that? Okay. Sarah Atkinson will carry Dr. Goldberg. Thanks. We're going to open a is she here? All right. A public hearing on Senate Bill 722. It will only be No, I'm just going to do public hearing at this point in time. Representative Kelly Worth must be in the room, and I don't see her. Hi. Come on up. Have you been there for a while?
Yeah.
Okay, good. My apologies. We have the nursing action item, so when Jason gets back, I'm going to open that and then go back to public hearing.
SJR 29.
Yeah, we can move that one.
Good luck.
Representative Worth, please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is State Representative Kelly Worth, and I appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you here today. I am here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 722. As many of you probably know, the city of Corvallis was the first city in the state to ban smoking in bars and taverns. Our non-smoking ordinance was adopted by our city council in 1997, and challenged by initiative just the following year and upheld overwhelmingly by the voters of Corvallis that following year. So despite threats that the Corvallis ban would do no less than cripple our local businesses, clearly the patrons of Corvallis do not consider a smoke-free environment to be a deterrent to frequenting their local businesses. It has created, in my opinion and the opinion of many others in Corvallis, a healthier experience in the city and has actually enhanced the ability of many community members to go out and enjoy themselves. In terms of the health aspects, the choice of one person to smoke should not affect the other patrons of the restaurant or bowling alley. Cigarette smoke affects more people than just the person choosing to light up the cigarette or whatever piece of tobacco. The University of Adelaide found that chemicals and cancer-causing agents are found in non-smoking areas in restaurants, even though there may be a partition or a wall. I'd also like to refer to data collected by Dr. Richard Sargent in Helena, Montana, who fought for an indoor smoking ban and noticed that heart attacks fell by half the summer after the community passed the ban. The Journal of the American Medical Association confirms that the restaurant and bar workers who are exposed to secondhand smoke are 50% more likely to get lung cancer from secondhand smoke than other workers. By expanding the Indoor Clean Air Act law, which we passed in 2001, we will be covering lounges inside of restaurants to ensure that the most vulnerable members of our society are not exposed to the dangers of secondhand smoke. This bill would also cover all common areas and bowling alleys and similar family-oriented business establishments. This bill is good for the health of our communities. It will lower employees' exposure to dangerous chemicals and carcinogens and will implement the will of the people, 86% of whom agree they should be protected from secondhand smoke. So I entertain any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much for the work. Next, we'll take Marie Hudson, please. Welcome to the committee. You traveled 100 miles and got up the queue here.
I got over the snowy pass, too. Thank you very much for letting me come. And knowing that you're going to hear from the rest of the people over here, the only thing I want to actually contribute...
We need to have you identify yourself for the record.
Okay,
thank you. That's okay.
Marie Hudson. I'm from Bend, Oregon. I've been in Oregon 3 years. I am from the United Kingdom originally. I've been a nurse for 15 years. So I'm really here wearing three hats as a consumer, non-smoker, as a healthcare professional, but also as a citizen in Oregon. The only thing I think I would have that's original to contribute is that how do you help an addict? Having taken care of tobacco-addicted patients for 15 years, in the VA, a doctor would write an order and I'd take them outside so they could smoke. I mean, we've come a long way, but how do you not eat a chocolate chip cookie if you're on a diet? How do you not do any of these things? You take it away. So if we really could prevent people from having the cigarette in family establishments, the bowling alleys, the lounges, it would make it, we would be helping them help themselves. As a consumer, I could go to bowling alleys. I know I could be good at bowling if there was no smoking. So that's really it. I just know that this will just make the bill better. And it was worth driving all this way to come over to see this and realize that it's quite humorous. It's not as entertaining as the soap operas, but it's nice to see that people care enough to come forward and see. It is a soap opera. It could be a soap opera. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate you traveling so far to be here today.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 722. Don't worry. We will come back to it immediately. I'm going to open a hearing and work session on the appointments to the Board of Nursing. Mr.
Yes,
Stembridge.
We have a packet of information on five candidates for the nursing, the Oregon State Board of Nursing. These are appointees from the governor, Sandy Theus, Marguerite Gutierrez, Beverly Shields, Janet Wright, Rolf Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. Is there a motion on those
That's
appointments? Senator Atkinson.
Would you like all five in block?
In block would be delightful.
I would move the five in block
Senator Atkinson has moved in bloc the appointments of Sandy Theis, Margaret Gutierrez, Bev Shields, Janet Wright, Ralph Olson to the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Is there any discussion to the motion? Any objection to the motion? It's so ordered. Senator Burdick or Senator Beyer, would either one of you like to be the carrier?
Okay.
Senator Burdick will carry, unless you wanted to.
I think one is from my district.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Then.
The carry and executive appointments calendar.
I do not know that.
my sensitivity to actually, if you wouldn't mind, I would like to carry these.
We're gonna
let. I'll trade you for Dr. Goldberg, who's from my district.
I've already told Dr. Goldberg that I could lift up Goldberg if he would like me to do so, but I'd be glad to.
No, you go ahead. Carry both.
I've been living with nurses for 108 days. I'd love to.
You carry them both, Senator Atkinson. You'll do a wonderful job.
He's going to work up on Senator Walker's record here.
Senator Atkinson will carry the members to the Board of Nursing. And while we're doing business, I need a motion. There is one LC draft before us. Mr. Stenbridge, why don't you tell us what we have?
You discussed this one a week ago. This is the one from Senator Winters where they needed to change the relating clause. It's just a redraft. This is for filing by Senator Winters and Senator Courtney on the Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I would move that we adopt LC 3544 as a committee bill.
Yeah, it would just be, I think you want us to approve it for an introduction by Senators Winters and Courtney. So moved.
Senator Atkinson had moved LC 3544 for introduction, for approval and introduction by this committee. Questions, Senator Beyer?
I was temporarily distracted by the good center on my left here. What did you say about changing relating clauses?
This is actually a bill draft that we needed because the relating clause wasn't broad enough to address Senator Courtney's and Senator Winter's concerns.
The background on it, a little bit more detail. The original bill said a foundation, the Oregon State Fair Foundation, and they decided in the course of amending it that they wanted to open up to other foundations and amend it to include other foundations, and found out that the relating clause wouldn't allow that. So it's just been changed, the relating clause.
So
we've actually introduced a whole new bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're not changing the relating clause on the bill.
That is correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Since that is forbidden. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the motion is approved. Thank you. And with that, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 722, going to the top of the list, seeing that we don't have any other folks outside the 100-mile radius. I'm going to ask for three folks to come up in a panel, John Valley, Richard Jacobus, and Courtney Dresser. Please proceed.
Okay, my name is Richard Jacobus, and I reside in Columbia County out in Columbia City, Oregon. I'm here to testify. First, I want to say thank you to the senators who have brought this bill back. Say thank you, thank you, thank you. And as I explain my personal situation, you'll see why I say thank you, thank you, thank you. I have heart disease, but I'm also a musician, and I like to play in, and we play in Gresham Elks, the Milwaukee Elks, VFW halls, those kind of facilities. And let me tell you, it's really terrible. When you leave there, you're sick for the next couple of days. So I want to say, this is not about the right to smoke. It's no different than why is not why aren't we smoking? I know there's smokers in the room. Why aren't we smoking here in the chambers? And I'm part of that 30,000 smokers or workers that got left out. We got left out, and we have to suffer the consequences. You could say, well, you don't have to get to play music. Well, let me tell you my credentials. I'm retired out of the fire service. I was a fire marshal for 10 years at St. Helens Fire District, very active in public policy with state fire code. I was on the public health board out there, Columbia County Health Board, for 8 years. And I'm a past restaurant owner, a current catering ballroom owner. And again, I play music, and I'm retired, and I want to continue. I love to play music. And you say, well, your choice is don't go playing in bars or lounges or clubs that have smoking. And there's a few communities, and St. Helens also was one that did pass some regulation on a smoke-free workplace. Although it was milked down and overturned based on the bar owners, lounge owners, and to exempt some of the bars and lounges. So we did okay. It's a little more stringent than the state, but we're still back. The other point that I guess I want to bring to the senators is, why is OSHA not involved with this? Is it because it is money? I mean, in a life safety issue with a fire marshal's office, state fire marshal. I also worked a year with the state fire marshal, and I'm going, Article 80 deals with life safety issues with liquids, gas, and solids. And there are requirements, and OSHA is there, and I work with the OSHA inspectors, and we walked hand in hand through facilities like Boise Cascade Paper Mill and looked at the hazardous material, chlorine and other gaseous chemicals, and yet OSHA is not involved in worker safety, which again, I'm not going to get into the documentation of the health risk, other than I know it's a health risk. I have heart disease. I've had a triple bypass in 96, probably because of the career that I chose. And if I'm in the secondhand smoke, it does really put me at risk for another heart attack. Anybody that has heart disease, known or unknown, is at a real high risk of having a heart attack, because it constricts, the smoke then constricts your blood vessels, and if there is any blockage at all, there's a chance for a heart attack. So I'm here. I'm just saying again, thank you, senators, and the sponsors of this bill, and the workers, and I'm one of those workers. I'm a musician, a professional musician, who say thank you for bringing it to you. Please consider our health. Please, Yeah, and I can't say anymore. Please consider, I look to Ireland, I look to New York, and I look to California. One last and closing statement would be, I was always very proud of the state of Oregon being a very progressive state in policies for protection of health issues and prevention, obviously, in the fire life safety issue. And to me, this is not about the right to smoke. And in our community, where people can't smoke, the workers or otherwise, they go outside or they have a covered area that they can smoke. And it's not about the right to smoke, as I know that the tobacco people were going to claim. This is about a health issue. And so I urge your vote and support for this Senate Bill 772. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is John Valley. I'm the advocacy director here in Oregon for the American Heart Association. I believe you have a copy of my written testimony. I'll just try to summarize that, because I know a lot of people want to testify. And I'll note that I know it's the afternoon, even though I said it was morning in my written testimony. It just demonstrates the kind of week I've been having. Anyway, I would like to share the Heart Association's strong support for Senate Bill 722. And I think I'd like to lead off by saying I think it's making a good law better. I think the legislature back in 2001 realized the dangers of secondhand smoke and how it affects the public health, and they realized that we needed to protect, at the time, 95% of workers. And we did do that, and I think this bill will attempt to protect more workers. And as the gentleman to my left had just recently said, there's 30,000 workers who are still not protected. It's important to remember that secondhand smoke contains over 50 cancer-causing chemicals, including benzene, cadmium, formaldehyde, and nickel. I think that's one of the reasons we've seen a lot of communities across the country and even internationally protect all workers from secondhand smoke, the reference to Ireland, New York. Here in Oregon, we've already had communities and representatives from those communities talk about what's been happening in Corvallis and Eugene. And 86% of Oregonians say they feel people should be protected from secondhand smoke. And this bill attempts to do that. I'd just like to end in closing about what's been happening this session around tobacco control. Recently, the Master Settlement Agreement has been securitized over at least, I think, the next 10 years. We've always felt that some of that money should be spent on tobacco prevention and education cessation services. That's not going to be happening anytime soon. We have also recently seen the Tobacco Prevention Education Program, the state-funded program for Measure 44 and recently passed Measure 20. For the rest of this biennium, that program has now been defunded. As of next week, there will be no tobacco prevention education programs in place across the state. The quit line will be closed. This bill is an attempt to show that Oregon's willing to do something about tobacco control, despite those other things that have been happening over the last few months. So I urge your support of Senate Bill 722. I'll be happy to take questions now or after Courtney testifies. Thank you very much.
Courtney, go ahead.
For the record, I'm Courtney Dresser. I'm the Oregon Advocacy Manager for the American Cancer Society. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 722. Exposure to secondhand smoke is the third leading cause of preventable death. The EPA has classified secondhand smoke as a Group A carcinogen, meaning that it's known to cause cancer in humans. And I'm not going to read this word for word. I'll just summarize. There's been two scientific groups who have come together to list many of the reasons why public policy on secondhand smoke needs to take place. A couple of those findings said that each year 3,000 non-smoking adults die of lung cancer as a result of breathing in secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke contains over 4,000 substances, more than 40 of which are known or suspected to cause cancer in humans and animals. In 2001, you all passed Senate Bill, or House Bill 2828, which was the workplace smoke-free workplace law. And a poll that was done in late 2002, a statewide poll, 76% of Oregonians said they support the law. Other cities and states, have you heard, have been doing this, including Eugene, Corvallis, Helena, Montana, Boston, Massachusetts, California, Delaware, Ottawa, Canada, and even Ireland. In the packet, I do have that article from the Irish Examiner that a couple of the legislators pointed out. And I also have in there the study that's been mentioned by many of the legislators that just happened in Helena, Montana. They voted in their smoke-free ordinance in June 2002, which made all workplaces, including their casinos, bars, and taverns, smoke-free. After the law went into effect, two doctors from that area did a study. They basically charted 4 years of case history of AMIs, which is acute myocardial infarctions. Within the city limits and outside of the city limits, they did it by zip code. What they saw was in the 6 months that the law was working and in place, Helena Hospital saw 60% less AMIs compared to the same time period in the previous 4 years. The doctors there concluded that the study suggests that 100% of smoke-free ordinances have an important and immediate effect on cardiac risk within their community. I have copies of that, and both doctors are available via phone if you guys have any questions. I have their phone numbers. This bill also would initially eliminate smoking in family-friendly bowling alleys. In Hermiston, Oregon, where is a rural community, there's not many places for young people to go on the weekends, but there is a bowling alley. However, smoking is allowed. I have for you all letters from several Hermiston High School students asking you to make their bowling alley that they use not only for personal use but also for club sports within their schools to be smoke-free, which this bill would do, and those are, again, are in your packet. Like my colleague from the Heart Association said, it's not been the best session for tobacco control movement.
not only has the MSA been securitized in the next 10 years, we also had our program, the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program, defunded and suspended for the rest of this biennium. I think it's time for this legislative body to tell Oregonians that they care about the effects of secondhand smoke. In Oregon, we regulate many things that happen within restaurants and bars. We regulate the quality of the food we serve. We regulate the quality of the water they use. We even regulate when employees have to wash their hands. However, we don't regulate the quality of the air we breathe while in the restaurants and the bar. Senate Bill 722 would reduce the effects of secondhand smoke on children and families now and would phase in all workers and workplaces in the immediate future. The Cancer Society asks for your support of Senate Bill 722. I also have, I think, American Lung Association presented testimony to and a letter from a bartender in Eugene. All that you have.
Sorry, Kenson, any questions? Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next up, I have Ron and Tracy Tabb and Jim Adams. Good afternoon and welcome. Would you please state your names for the record?
My name is Ron Tabb. I moved to Oregon in 1980 to train for the United States Olympic Trials. I now reside in Beaverton, and I own and manage a sports bar in Tigard, and I'm also the head men's and women's track and cross-country coach at Pacific University in Forest Grove.
My name's Tracy Tabb, and we have a family bar in Tigard, Oregon.
Senator Atkinson?
What event?
Marathon.
Okay, please proceed with your testimony.
Okay, well, I've prepared a few statements that I'd like to share with you, so let me put my glasses on so I can read to you. Anyway, I'd like to thank you for giving me or allowing me the opportunity to share my concerns regarding the loopholes the tobacco industry and some businesses have uncovered to permit smoking in bars and restaurants here in Oregon. I'm here today to support Oregon's smoke-free workplace law, and at the present time, I'm being discriminated against regarding the Oregon smoke-free workplace law because I am a bar owner and manager. Currently, Oregon has 95% of the workforce protected from secondhand smoke. We just happen to be in the 5% that isn't protected. Let me present these questions to you. Why isn't 100% of Oregon's workplace protected at this time? Are we going to continue to allow the tobacco industry and businesses find loopholes in the laws to allow the selfish and self-centered smokers inflict their dangerous habit on the innocent non-smoker? Are you willing to establish laws to protect the rights of all non-smokers in the workplace? Why do Oregon lawmakers continue to allow the tobacco industry to push its hazardous products on unwilling souls? And why are we non-smokers always having to justify our right to breathe clean air? Permitting smoking in the workplace is an injustice to all non-smokers. Being exposed to secondhand smoke drastically increases a non-smoker's health risk, which in turn increases the non-smoker's medical insurance. And speaking of insurance, I've been denied life insurance simply because I work in the bar and restaurant industry. This is very disturbing to me, as I'm 48 years old and probably among the top 5% of the most healthy people in Oregon. I'm a former Olympic marathon runner who continues to run daily, and for the simple fact that I own a sports bar, I cannot get reasonably priced life insurance. That isn't right. However, I could get reasonably priced life insurance if Oregon law would provide me with a healthy, smoke-free workplace. 100% of all Oregonians should have a right to work in a smoke-free environment, not just the ones lawmakers pick and choose to protect. Non-smokers should have as much right not to be exposed to secondhand smoke as the smoker has the right to smoke in his or her own home. We all know the secondhand smoke from a smoker indiscriminately reaches everyone's lungs who is near. There is no solution to the problem other than banning smoking in all workplaces. I do believe smokers' rights, but not at the expense of my health, my wife's health, my employees' health, and any other patrons who are non-smokers. Many bar owners are afraid there would be a decline in their sales if they didn't cater to the smoker, and I'm also included in that. But if all businesses were forced to comply with the state law or the state ban, I'm certain the effects would be short-term, and in the long run, a total smoking ban would increase revenues. In closing, enough evidence has been presented over the past several years regarding the dangerous effects of smoking, and more recently, the dangerous effects of secondhand smoke. I'd like to present to you one last question. Is it right for me, as a lifelong non-smoker, to be forced to tolerate the health risk that tobacco smoker places on me? Again, thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak at this hearing. I personally feel discriminated against having to work in a smoking environment. When it has been proven that secondhand smoke causes cancer, I feel Oregon smoke-free workplace law should include bars and restaurant workers, because we are 50% more likely to get lung cancer from secondhand smoke than any other workers. Employees in bars are not covered by Oregon's current smoke-free laws and can breathe up to a pack of secondhand smoke in a regular shift. We inhale at least 4.5 times more secondhand smoke than if we lived with a smoker. Ventilation, air filters, and separate smoking sections cannot control the risk of secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke is the third leading cause of preventable death in the United States, killing 53,000 non-smokers each year. As an owner and bartender, I am forced to breathe secondhand smoke every day. I have never been a smoker, but I feel the same health effects because I work in a smoking environment. I've witnessed and have had smoke health problems from breathing smoke at my job, reduced energy, sinus infections, headaches, and I get sick more often. I am forced to breathe secondhand smoke that customers have blown into my face or my direction. An example, a bar that holds 100 people and 70% of the people are smoking, how many cigarettes is a non-smoking worker breathing during an 8-hour shift? I have had people say to me numerous times that they only smoke when they drink, and they wish there was some kind of law that they would not feel so free to smoke when they drink. I myself have been refused life insurance at a non-smoker rate because I work in a bar, therefore I breathe secondhand smoke. They're giving me higher premiums. As an owner, I see firsthand how much it costs a business because of smoking. Carpet repairs, cleaning costs, smoke air filter systems, ashtray, painting, and problems with employees because they want to smoke all day long. I believe we lose customers in the long run because people do not want to smell smoke when they eat, drink, or on their clothes after they leave the establishment. As an Oregonian and a taxpayer, I would like the same rights as other working Oregonians, a safe, smoke-free work environment for myself and coworkers. The Oregon smoke-free workplace law should not exclude me. My right to breathe clean air is just as important as any office worker. Every Oregonian deserves to work in clean air free from secondhand smoke, and when they leave their job, they should not smell smoke in their hair, on their skin, and on their clothes. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
My name is Jim Adams, Portland, Oregon. The people of Oregon have always been progressive in their attitude toward the environment. An example of this is the bottle bill to prevent pollution. We should follow this with the elimination of secondhand smoke in the workplace. My wife works in a deli that serves alcohol and thereby falls into the loophole that we are addressing today. The elimination of the loophole in the law will give workers and patrons alike the right to pollution-free air to breathe. Oregon should be the next state to take the step toward being a smoke-free workplace state. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you mind if I ask you a couple questions about your business?
Sure.
From what I heard you say, is that you actually allow smoking in your sports bar or tavern. Is that right?
Yes.
Have you tried to prohibit smoking?
We're afraid to because there is so much competition in the area. When we took over the business, it was an established business, and we were afraid that we would offend the clientele that we cater to. So it's a risk. Believe me, if I thought we could make it a non-smoking bar and continue to make a profit, I would have no problem with doing that. I would be the first one in line to do that. If my contention is that if all of bars and restaurants were playing on the same playing field, I think we'd have be able to see These customers stay at the local establishments that they frequent without offending them. And I'm afraid that if we do turn our establishment, and we have two, if we turned our establishments into non-smoking establishments, we would offend the clientele that we've established over the years.
Other questions? Like, what's the name of the bar?
Dr. Feelgoods.
Okay.
Thanks. Sorry.
Well, thanks for coming. We appreciate you being here this afternoon.
We'll even we'll buy you a round if you come in and
look.
Jennifer Hale, Lauren Gaucher, and David Ray.
Hi. My name is Lauren Gaucher. Thank you for pronouncing it right.
Oh, I'm impressed. I was worried that I'd mess
it. No, I can't get the little thing over the E on the computer, so I just kind of hope people will wing it. And I'm from Portland, Oregon. And I work at the Veritable Quandary. I'm a server. And I've been working in the restaurant industry for 6 years since I was 17. And I have been subjected to secondhand smoke once I turned 18 since then. It's made me very adamant about smoking laws, and I really, really am in support of this. Although non-smoking bars, at least in Portland, are beginning to take hold, they are still few and far between, and jobs there are very sought after, even with smokers. Whenever I work at the bar in VQ, my eyes burn, I have a hard time breathing, and I find myself holding my breath when I'm at a table taking an order. That smoking, I'll just kind of hold my breath and kind of squeak out the responses to their orders. The next day I feel literally sick. My energy is diminished, and if when I finally do get sick, it takes me weeks to recover. When I'm working in the dining section of the restaurant, because we are a restaurant and bar, the smoke drifts over, and it affects both the staff and our customers often complain. VQ gets numerous complaints about secondhand smoke. The bar gets so smoky that I've had non-smoking customers leave. And then I'd also like to point out the bars, there's a couple bars, and the bars that I have seen go non-smoking that were previously a smoking bar, they went on their own accord, didn't actually see a drop in clientele, but from what I can tell, it's ragingly busy, and even smokers are happy to go there, just because it's sometimes smoking bars get even too much for themselves. I've made a conscious decision to be a non-smoker, and through secondhand smoke, that's pretty much negated my decision, I believe. I would be overjoyed to come to work and make money for 8 hours a day without subjecting myself to the harmful and painful effects of secondhand smoke.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My name is Jennifer Hale. I also live and work in Portland, Oregon as a waitress.
We need to know what restaurant you work at.
Oh, currently I work.
Oh. Well, it sure be great.
I work right now actually at a McMenamin's Market Street pub, which is non-smoking, and I chose to work there specifically for that reason, because prior to my employment there, I began working there in February. I was working for a restaurant that was a smoking restaurant. Before I got that, I'd been working there since July of 2002, before which I had let me backtrack a little bit. I chose to work at the non-smoking restaurant because I am asthmatic. So when I got my job at the smoking restaurant in July of 2002, I had not had any asthmatic symptoms for over 3 years. After this period, I immediately began noticing symptoms such as skin irritations, sinus pain, diminished energy levels, and reduced Airways. I couldn't breathe as well. My asthma started acting up. As soon as I started noticing these symptoms, I knew I needed to find another job. However, it took me 6 months between the beginning of my search for a job and actually finding the job that I have. Let's see. In a 2 month span, I went from not requiring any medication for over 3 years to needing several medications. I had to restrict my diet to control my asthma. My medical situation was also made more precarious by the fact that I was unable to afford quality medical care due to economic constraints. Because as is common with restaurant employment, my employer does not provide me with the benefit of medical insurance. Some of the medications I was using were expired because I'd had them for over 3 years since my last experience of needing any of them, and I just kept them on hand. Also, when it came to customers, I talked to several of them who were highly bothered by the smoking in the restaurant that I was in. The restaurant had a wall separating the two sections, non-smoking from smoking, but it didn't. They were still affected. They had the choice of being separated from the smoking areas. However, they often complained and sometimes would even leave before their meals were served due to their discomfort. As a server, I have no choice. I had no choice but to endure the smoking for 8 to 9 hours per day. I'm not a smoker and I've never smoked. I don't believe that it's fair to workers to restaurant workers to not provide them with the opportunity to choose for themselves whether or not to be exposed to secondhand smoke. I'm lucky, as she was saying, I'm lucky to have found a job in a non-smoking pub restaurant because they're in high demand. And so I've had several complaints from customers about their discomfort, and I've not had any complaints from customers about their discomfort of not being able to smoke in the restaurants I'm currently in. I believe it would be a hugely appreciated service to the citizens who work in the industry to give them the same benefits that are afforded to most Oregonians. And I appreciate you all being here to listen to us today.
My name is David Ray. I'm a manager of a veritable quandary in Portland, Oregon. Prior to becoming manager at that establishment, I worked for another restaurant called Oba that was a very swank and hip urban environment for a cross-section of ages from 50 to people in their 20s. It had a smoking bar and a non-smoking restaurant, but about 3 months before I negotiated employment at Veritable Quandary, they went non-smoking. And so I've stayed in touch with the owner, Steve McLean, to see how the business effects were, because I work in a restaurant where smoking is permitted in the bar. And like most restaurants that have a bar, there's really not a clear division between the two areas. So a lot of people are expressing concern for families and children. But I feel a concern for just everyone in general who comes in dying. The owner of Oba, not only did he not see a decrease in people patronizing his restaurant, but there was a dramatic increase, people lining up around the block on Fridays and Saturdays to come in there, smokers and non-smokers alike. And I work with probably about 50% of my staff as smokers, and I represent them today as well. They want a smoke-free workplace, and they would prefer to frequent places that were smoke-free. There's a ripple of conversation whenever a new place opens that's non-smoking, and we fill that place to capacity every time. So I'd like to pass the Senate bill because I think it actually would benefit everyone.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. For anyone, why does the BQ just go smoke-free?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not the owner. Otherwise, we'd do it immediately. The owner has owned the place for 30-some-odd years. He's a smoker. All of his friends who have been regulars for about 30 years are smokers. And truthfully, I've finally feel I've got him on the fence about it. Before, he was adamantly opposed to it, but he wanted to see some numbers and you know, of course, the fiscal aspect. And so when I began telling him Steve McLean's experience, he's now sort of wavering. And we may actually go non-smoking probably in the next year. He's at least seriously considering it. But it's really his pack of 15 friends that fill the place every evening after work. They're all lawyers. We occupy that section of town. We're about four blocks from the courthouse. So, but he's even talking about just building a covered patio out back, and if we can get their support, I'm sure we will. It would be nice to see it happen statewide.
Yeah, it's also the same as this gentleman was saying back there. If the playing field was leveled, then they don't have anywhere else to go, you know, smoking. Then the smokers will stay here, and also. The owner has heard complaint. I mean, because the owner comes into the bar, customers come up to him knowing he's the owner and complain to him themselves, and that's really increased recently. And I think that's also a reason why he's starting to really.
Yeah. And now that they know they have an option.
Yeah.
And at least with the VQ, you have to go through the.
Yeah.
The bar area.
That's correct.
To
yeah.
Get to the restaurant.
So if a family,
even children, yeah, they have to walk through the smoky bar to get to the dining room.
We're happy to show you at some point, Senator.
Quite a bit.
Oh, okay.
Good food, isn't it?
Yeah. We know, Senator Meyer. At some point, we'll take you to the big, great city of Portland. thank you. I don't see any further questions. We appreciate you coming down
thank
and testifying today. Last but not least, Debbie Kaufman and Mel Cohn. Oops, there it is. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Debbie Kaufman, and I'm a resident of Portland. As you probably know, we are fortunate in Multnomah County to have a smoke-free workplace law that is slightly stronger than the statewide law. Specifically, bowling alleys are included in our smoke-free workplace law, whereas they're exempted at the state level. However, I'm here this afternoon to talk to you about another problem with bowling alleys. Last December, my daughter wanted to celebrate her 10th birthday by going bowling with a few friends. Knowing that bowling alleys often have bars in them, I decided to call around first to make sure that I was going to a truly smoke-free place. I did not want to expose any of the girls to smoke, in particular my daughter, who has asthma. The first bowling alleys that I called were the ones that advertised smoke-free environments in the yellow pages. When I asked the additional question of smoking on the premises, they all said that smoking was allowed in the bar area. In the most populous area of our state, with a smoke-free bowling alley law in place, I could not find a bowling alley where I felt safe to take my daughter with asthma, or any child for that matter. We did not get her bowling party. They were cranky.
Well, it was to be the operating word for the day.
Disappointed was probably more accurate. Well, it was disappointing to have our party plans ruined, especially for a group of 10-year-olds. I think it is a much bigger problem for those who have to work every day in bowling alleys and bars. I'm sure that there are many young people among those who work in bowling alleys. I feel fortunate to work in an environment that does not allow smoking. I am thankful that because of my particular job skills and experience, I will probably never have to make a choice between my job and my health. I also do not believe that my health is more valuable than anyone else's health. Everyone should have a safe and healthy workplace, and I encourage you to support Senate Bill 722 and all Oregon workers. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thanks. I'd really encourage you to send your letter to the governor.
She does write to legislators.
Good. Okay. He just might be a little sympathetic on the bowling alley issue.
Right.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services, and I'm also a pediatrician. And I'm here today to testify on behalf of the department in support of this bill. I know the hour is late, and I'm going to be very brief. It's already the health effects of secondhand smoke have already been described, both the human face of that and the statistical face, if you will, that people who are exposed to secondhand smoke have a 35 to 50% increased risk of lung cancer, and a 40% increased risk of heart disease from this exposure. This is a very serious health problem, and one that I think the scientific debate about this as a health hazard is over. It clearly is a very, very important health hazard that needs to be reckoned with. Second of all, through some epidemiological data, we're able to estimate how many lives would be saved by closing this loophole in the existing law. And it's true that there are a little over 30,000 workers, we estimate, who currently are exempted from coverage under this law. If that loophole were closed, we estimate that 800 lives would be saved in Oregon's future with that law.
Dr. Cohn, is that per year or is that over a period of time?
That's indefinitely in the future. Of course, this is we're just talking about number of deaths. That doesn't even speak to the amount of dollars that are spent on health care costs, both by the state. We have very high smoking rates among our OMAP population, for example, about twice what they are in the general population. So the state certainly bears an enormous proportion of that. And we all do, all those of us who have private health insurance also bear that cost because it's distributed around to all of us. You know, you may hear some discussion about the economic impact of a law like this. What's it going to do to business? And I think the data on this is also exceptionally good, and I'm speaking here as an epidemiologist. There have been extensive studies on the effect of smoking restrictions on restaurant and bar sales, covering at least 81 communities in 6 states, including right here in Oregon. All of these analyses have relied on objective sales tax data, and they've all demonstrated that the restriction of smoking in restaurants and bars has no negative effect on revenues. Although there are no studies on bingo halls or bowling alleys in particular, there are 2 studies that address the effect of smoke-free laws on tourism and hotel revenues in 4 states, and they similarly found that hotel revenues in some localities actually increased, while in others business was simply unaffected. Now, while we're very concerned about the health of workers who are exposed to secondhand smoke, it's also important to note, as has already been mentioned, that children and families, particularly in some of the institutions that we're talking about here, bowling alleys, as was just described, are also exposed to this. And children have very many serious health risks as well, asthma exacerbation and so forth. So in closing, we feel at the department that this is a very fair and reasonable approach to address the health risks posed by secondhand smoke and urge you to support it. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you. Anybody else in the audience wishing to testify? Okay. That means that we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 722. Is there any business to become before the committee today at 5 o'clock on Thursday? Is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify on the other 2 measures that were before us today, SJR 8 or SJR 29? Mr. Strobeck?
Let him come back.
SJR 8 will open a public hearing.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to come back another day if you'd prefer. I know the time is late. Senator.
This might be your last opportunity.
For the record, I'm Ken Strobeck, Executive Director of the League of Oregon Cities, and here to testify in support of SJR 8 as you heard a couple hours ago from Senator Morissette, as well as from Ken Tolinar. I really appreciated his testimony. He's really the guy who kind of wrote the book on local government in Oregon, having been with the Bureau of Governmental Research for many years. I just want to hit a couple of points about the measure, which is that it really helps to reestablish the historical relationship between the different levels of government in Oregon. We all serve the same constituents, as he said, is elected by the same people, as you are elected by the same people who elect city councils, county commissions. We provide different functions, however. The state, I don't think, wants to get into the business of running local water and sewer systems, and I don't believe that cities want to get into the business of running state prisons, for example. But simply because we do different things doesn't mean that one level of government is better than the other level of government. And simply because the legislature has the power to preempt local government doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do. Special interests frequently run to the legislature to change something they don't like at the local level. They say, make them stop, for example. Use of this argument of uniformity doesn't recognize the diverse nature of our state that includes cities all over the different areas of the state, from the coast to the mountains to east to urban to rural. The key provision in this whole bill is the adopted charter, and under the historical interpretation of the home rule provision, cities do have authority to make decisions within their own boundaries, and they answer to the local voters. And we've seen cases in this last election where local voters didn't like the direction of one council, and they throw them out and elect somebody else. So it's really a self-correcting system. And I see this measure as similar to the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which says that powers that are not specifically delegated to the federal government belong to the states. And I think this is sort of a re-recognition that the powers that are not specifically delegated to the state legislature really reside with those local communities where they have adopted a charter to govern themselves. And I would appreciate your support of the bill.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm not going to go through my testimony. I'll leave it there. Hopefully you'll have an opportunity to read it. I did want to note that attached to the testimony, I have included a copy of the pamphlet that both Senator Morissette and Mr. Tolinar referenced, the case for local self-government, and hope that sometime when you're having difficulty falling asleep at night that you might pick that up and look through it. I think it's a very, very interesting, informative study that Mr. Tolinar has put together. Again, we, Association of Oregon Counties, would encourage you to affirmatively approve SJR 8 and send the question to the voters for their consideration. Counties came into home rule authority many years after the cities. And in fact, in 1958, as Mr. Tolinar indicated, the constitutional authority was passed. Since that time, 9 of the 36 counties have adopted charters. And this is an important matter, we feel, of restoring the balance between state responsibility and local control. And SJR 8 would simply affirm that in those cases where there is an issue that the prevailing purpose of that issue, whether it would be state or local, would prevail and reestablish what we feel was at one time the balance between state responsibility and local concerns. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks for staying so long this afternoon. Any other persons in the room? Genoa, did you want to testify? Okay. Any other persons in the room wishing to testify on any of the matters in front of us today? Seeing no volunteers, we are going to adjourn for the day and for the week. Travel carefully.